Yeah, that's it. It's checkmate. Because you can't do that because of the bishop. I just like the game.
When you're at the board, you're trying to basically solve an ever-changing logic puzzle.
Welcome to Radio Free School.
You can't go there.
Wasn't he here?
No.
Can I move like that?
Yeah. I wouldn't Six. Play like that.
Go what?
Go.
Did you
go? Yeah.
How many points did I get?
I'm Jerry Kitch with the Hamilton City Chess Club. Here to talk today about chess. I read in a book once how many different ways they're playing of just the first 10 moves. And it's there's a number of ranges right off the page. And the author was just basically saying that no two games will ever repeat themselves. There's infinite possibilities in the game. You'll never exhaust the game or repeat a game. And you're totally in charge of your own plans, of your own ideas, of your own actions. And nobody else is telling you what to do when you're at the board. You're trying to basically solve an ever-changing logic puzzle, which is basically what chess is, because there's a certain configuration of pieces, and you're looking at them and you're trying to solve the best way you can the logic of that position. Then you make a move, your opponent makes a move, and now the position is totally changed. And you again have another logic problem, somewhat related to the first problem because that was the position it came from, but now totally changed. So it's a totally changing, ever-evolving game with infinite possibilities, and it's instead of just one logic puzzle, it's a logic puzzle every time you or your opponent moves. In chess history, basically chess came from, the nearest we can tell, it came from an Indian about 900. And we have some record of it coming from India to Persia. From Persia, it made its way through Europe, I believe it was through the Moorish invaders of Spain. It traveled to Europe that way. So the characters actually aren't really the original characters from India. They're more the medieval characters that the game developed through Europe. So we have knights, which we look very simple on a standard chess piece. It's just a horse's head. But actually it's supposed to represent a knight in armor on a horse. We have castles, which are, you can either look at them as castles, medieval castles, or you can look at them, some people think they come from elephants that were used in the Indian game. So mostly the figures that we have today come from the evolution of chess in medieval Europe. And some of the things that you would find on the battlefield of medieval Europe, castles, obviously people would besiege castles. There would be lots of knights, you know, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, and there'd be all the knights on horseback. And then you would have the regular foot soldiers who wouldn't be on horseback, and those are the pawns on the chessboard. And there'd be a lot of those because you would just get all the peasants or the farmers and give them some swords and say, okay, let's go fight the invader or let's go fight a war. So you'd have a lot of those pawns, regular foot soldiers. And we also, you know, we have the bishop, which represents the church, a very important thing too in medieval Europe. And you'd have, of course, the monarchy. So you'd have the king and the queen representing the power of the throne and of the government, basically. And the whole object of chess is to capture the king. So when you capture the opposing side's king, then you've won the game. Sort of like even what's happening today Although we don't necessarily like to relate chess to a war game, it's not really a war game per se. It did evolve out of that, but if you take a look at what's happening in the world today, the United States is trying to find Saddam Hussein. So it's sort of like a giant chess game where they're trying to capture the leader of the opposite side and put him in checkmate, sort of. And every figure has a different way it moves. So therefore, it's easier for the player when they look at the board and they see a different figure, a different shape. They know that the pawn, all the pawns move a particular way, all the knights move a particular way, and it just makes it easier for the player. So you can see that the figures have changed quite a bit. The queen figure, there's some debate about whether that was originally a female figure. It certainly is now, and well established that it is a female figure now in the queen. But there are some indications that early on in chess history, it represented actually the second in command, or the vicar of the army, who was acting for the king. The pieces have evolved, even some of the rules have evolved. As late as maybe 1200, so about 800 years ago, the pawns were able to move only one space forward on their first move. Now they can move up one or two, depending on what the player wants to use. So some of the rules have evolved too, as well. Philidor was a great player in the 1700s, and he basically said the pawns were the soul of chess, because the pawns create the structure that the pieces have to operate through. If you think of it back to the reference of an army, a medieval army, where you have the pawns with their swords and their spears and things like that, then you have the knights and all the other pieces behind them, a lot of thought has to be given to where you're going to place your foot soldiers in the terrain. So therefore, they basically set the structure of the battlefield. And not only that, but there is the fact that pawns, when they reach the opposite side, can then become any other piece that they want to be. Usually a player will make them the queen because the queen's the strongest piece. So that's basically the decisive point of the endgame.
You are listening to Radio Free School on CFMU.
When you're first learning to play chess, and it's a very simple game to learn to play initially. I mean, there's only 8 pieces basically. So you've got 6 types of pieces. You have pawns, rooks, knights, bishops, the queen, and the king for 6. And all the pawns move the same way, the rooks, the knights move the same way. The queen moves in a sort of a combination way. It can move the same way as a rook does, it can move the same way as bishops do. So you can initially learn how the pieces move, and then you get into a game, and you just have to develop this a feel to know what you should be looking at the point that you're playing. So you first have to develop the idea of looking out for danger for yourself. Since the idea of chess is to checkmate the king, you want to make sure the king isn't checkmated. So you first quickly learn to take care of your king's safety. When you start with the same number of pieces your opponent does, and you don't want to get behind. Make sure you don't lose any material so that the game becomes uneven, because unless you intentionally want to give up some material, because maybe you can checkmate his king if you're making a sacrifice, or you can, some openings you give up a pawn right away just to have a quicker attack. But in general, you want to keep your pieces even unless you really are going to get something for giving up your pieces. So it's the hierarchy of when you first go from a beginner to being a more experienced player. You develop in your mind what things you should be looking at and what things you should make sure you have under control, and what things you have to address before you go any further. You can't sort of make a little plan over here when in reality you have to take care of the fact there's an attack on your king, or you have to take care of the fact that you're maybe going to lose some material. There's also a hierarchy of players. Obviously, different players are of different strength. Even among grandmasters, there are people who are masters because they reached a certain rating level. All chess players have a certain rating. It's a case of you can be a master, but there's a big difference even among the masters. They're the super masters, the super grandmasters, who are world chess champions, like Bobby Fischer, Garry Kasparov, Anatoly Karpov. There's the men or women who are good national players and maybe the best players in that country, but they may not be the super grandmasters, the world's best players. They may not be in the top 10 or the top 100, but they are actually masters. So there's a whole hierarchy even among the masters. I mean, the world champion has sometimes played 6 grandmasters simultaneously and beat them all, playing them all at once. Bobby Fischer was very dominant in his time, and he was a grandmaster, and the players he played were generally grandmasters. But he didn't lose. Between 1962 and 1972, He finished first in every tournament he played in except two, where he finished second, very close second. So, I mean, he was certainly the dominant player in his time. And it's just a question of, it's sort of like artists or musicians. There are people who are really good musicians, and there are people who are world-class artists. There are painters who can paint and paint terrific paintings. There are people who are contemporaries of Picasso, but they weren't Picasso. They weren't pushing the boundaries of what he was doing. There's huge debates in styles. I mean, Anatoly Karpov, who took over for Bobby Fischer, he was a very much a safe player. He wanted to, first of all, not lose the game. And then Garry Kasparov came along, and his idea was to win at all costs, even if it took risks. So there was a big clash of personalities there. And he was pushing the boundary of what it should be, whether chess should just be play it safe, don't lose, or whether it should be fight as much as you can to try and win. There's been a lot of battles in chess just based on personality. I mean, there's one fellow, Mikhail Tal, who was called the wizard or magician from Riga because he was very tactical. He could, a lot of attacks. He could create attacks from it almost seemed from nothing, because it didn't necessarily look like there was a big attack there. But he would create all these attacks, and people were really fascinated. That's why they called him the magician or the wizard. And he played Botvinnik, both were Soviet, who Botvinnik had a very positional style, very careful style. And Tal beat him the first time because Tal was able with his tactics to just generate such strong attacks that Botvinnik couldn't do anything about it. When they had the rematch, Botvinnik decided, I'll purposely keep things quiet. I'll choose openings, I'll choose tailor my play so that everything is very sort of quiet and I can use my positional understanding, which is what happened. He beat Tal the second time around because he imposed his will on Tal as far as not allowing Tal to play the way that Tal wanted to play. Not only is it a case of individual personality, a one player versus another player, but much like art, there are whole schools of thought that come up. A lot of the principles that a modern player would understand haven't always been the way in that case. Certainly were not the case in medieval Europe. So the early stages of chess was sort of the romantic stage, is what we call it, where a lot of just attack, just go forward and attack no matter what. Give up pieces, give up pawns, just get open space so you can attack the other king. Force the other king out into the open and attack. And Paul Morphy, who was an American, was the brilliant genius in that time of romantic chess. Then players came along like Alekhine and Nimzovic and started to get these principles, and they started to beat everybody. So people started to pay attention. What are these principles that Nimzovic and these other players are starting to use? And they said, what do they understand that we don't understand? Why do our simple, straightforward attacks no longer work? Why is it that the opponent seems not to be able to defend against all these our strongest attacks? So what is it about these new thoughts? So for a while there, it was thought that you had to basically control the center by pushing your pawns into the center. You push your pawn into the center, your pawn is there, it's occupying the center, it's controlling squares. And that was sort of a dogmatic approach, some people thought. Some people thought, well, can't you do it anywhere else? It just seems so simple and direct. You just pick up your pawn, put it in the center, and there it is. So they thought, what if we control the center through our pieces on the side? So what if we have our bishops not in the center, but pointing at the center? What if we have our knights not in the center, but controlling squares in the center? So that's where the hypermodern movement came out. And they had all sorts of, back then I guess you could call them crazy openings, where, it was just a total change of thought. Much like when people saw Impressionist paintings, they thought, what are they doing? This is nonsense. This isn't art at all. Well, the same thing happened with hypermodern chess, where they started saying, well, you can't play that way. You must put your pawn in the center. That's the only way to play chess. And it turned out not to be true, because all these openings, the new openings, the hypermodern openings, one of them is called the modern Alekhine's, and the different names they gave to the openings. They worked despite the fact that they went against the accepted dogma of that day. And so there were whole schools of thought and a whole clashes between schools of thought of how to play chess. The whole school of thought that changed from the Romantic era to the classical era, it's called, and then to the hypermodern era. And today we incorporate all three of those styles. A player is free to pick among any of the openings that he wants to use from any of those eras, although very few people play the romantic style, because the state of chess is just such that your opponent's going to know how to defend. One of the great things about chess is that when we talk about these eras, people may wonder, well, how do you know how chess was played back then? You know, you weren't around then. But the wonderful thing about chess is that every game can be recorded. So we use different systems of notation of recording the game. So we're able to play over any game that's been recorded and passed down to us. So I can play a game over from the Romantic era, maybe of 300 years ago or 400 years ago. And we have early chess games from the 1600s. So I can see exactly what the players did. In the same way, I can see what the players did, you know, at a big tournament in Europe last week. We have chess magazines or chess books or all those resources where we can see the games and we can play it over at our own pace and study it in our own living room. So it's recorded just like a piece of music is recorded. We know what Beethoven wrote when he wrote the Fifth Symphony because it's recorded. Today, everybody sort of plays chess. A lot of Europeans play chess. When I was in high school, I played on a team that was very ethnically diverse. Unfortunately, chess today is still male-dominated, unfortunately. We would like to attract a lot more female players. And there are a lot of strong women international players. But as a percentage, it is very low. At our club, we have everybody from steelworkers and city employees, lawyers, engineers. Well, it was really a whole gamut of players because, I mean, in the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer, there were the people who played it in the park who were from all walks of life. And if you go to Toronto on Yonge Street and Gould, there have been tables there for years where people play. It's people from all walks of life. Casual players, You know, living room players, not to put them down or anything, because they really are the backbone of chess. Some players may think it's about chess is all about defeating your opponent. It's not really. Chess is about understanding yourself first, understanding your own weaknesses, understanding your own strengths, understanding your own ability to come to terms with your thoughts. Because when you're sitting at the board and everything is quiet and you're thinking all sorts of different things, and your thoughts may be at first be a jumble, and you're thinking, wow, if I do this, he'll do this. If I do this, he'll do that. And you may not really be focused, but coming to terms with yourself and settling yourself down, forcing yourself to concentrate, forcing yourself to not be overly optimistic. Some players are very optimistic. Some players think no matter what's happening that they're winning. Some players are overly pessimistic. They think, I can't possibly win because this player is supposed to be a stronger player than I am. So it's first coming to terms with your own thoughts and feelings and emotions while you're playing. But in a way, it's not even about your opponent. It's more about yourself. It's more about coming to terms with yourself. When I was a youngster, I grew up playing my father, and we used to play to see who would wash the dishes. And at the beginning, I washed a lot more dishes than I won chess games. But after about 3 or 4 years, I was when I entered high school, I was good enough to play on the high school team. I started around the age of 7, playing with my father's. We played 3, 4, 5 games a night, because I really didn't want to wash those dishes. So I just kept saying, well, can't you give me another chance? Let's play another game, you know, and finally I would have to go and wash the dishes. There are quite a number of what we would call children or teens who are international grandmasters, who are very strong players. So it's not a case where it matters what your age is in chess. It doesn't matter at all what your age is. Bobby Fischer was a grandmaster at 14. Well, there are two aspects of the great 1972 match between Bobby Fischer and Boris Spassky. One was the personalities involved, primarily Bobby Fischer's personality. And the other was the fact that there was a Cold War, that it was an American versus a Soviet. It held the world in fascination, that particular championship, unlike any previous championship before that. Bobby Fischer's personality, he devoted himself to chess entirely at a very young age. I'm not suggesting anybody do that, because he sort of limited his options, but he saw what he wanted to do, and he wanted to be a world chess champion. Americans were fascinated not only by the fact that it was America versus the USSR and the democratic sort of way, the individualistic American way of pull yourself up by your own bootstraps versus the Soviet school of chess, where it was a system sort of, I mean, communism was a system and it was a system. That clash of personalities and politics all at once, it just made the world really, the world has never paid more attention to chess than they did in that 1972 championship. It's been the most important thing that's happened to chess, I think, ever. So today the debate seems to be mainly about can a person beat a computer, or can a computer ever beat a person? And the whole thrust seems to be the computer age and pitting the person against the computer. And there's been a few world champion versus computer matches. But those hold some interest. It's sort of interesting, but it doesn't have the excitement and the drama of the Bobby Fischer Boris Spassky 72 match. And the other things that make it fascinating is Bobby Fischer sort of has disappeared. He decided not to defend his championship, and we don't even know where he really is today. There are reports that he's in this country, he's in that country. He did resurface briefly in 1992. To play his old foe Boris Spassky in Yugoslavia, and then he disappeared just as quickly. Chess has this image that it's an intellectual game, and also at the same time it's fun. So I mean, I think that's why I get a lot of it in books like Alice in Wonderland. And a lot of people who wrote books, authors, were chess players themselves, so something they understood and knew, and thought that would add an element of fun to their books. The Harry Potter movies, you know, in some ways you can be your own wizard playing chess, because like I said, it's up to you to make your own plans, find your own best ideas. You're totally in control of your own moves and of your own plans. So I think chess does enjoy an image of being a very cerebral activity, of being a fun activity at the same time, of being a game, of being both a game and a sport and an art as well, all rolled up into one. So all those elements make it interesting for literature, for books. because it is a lot of fun.
Kings of Africa and the kings of Spain, the king of demons and the kings of pain. Up the lowrider, down in the seat, driving by while pumping the beat. Innocent bystanders all in a row, the white ones in drag, the black ones don't know. Prime examples of the primal need, cries for acceptance become cries of greed. To the best of darkness they give their regard, making hard so easy and easy so hard. Heroes born to dare statistics, forensic medicine and police ballistics. They only talk when it's time to cry, they only live when it's time to die. Famous fathers and famous sons, famous massacres with famous guns. From stick-up kid to B&E, from a trying birth to just trying to be. The sorrow in the color of daddy's eyes, living the pain of daddy's lies. Holding his memory, holding his hand, holding the gun that stole his land. Shooting up corners, shooting up dreams, shooting up veins and unconscious streams.
The kings of pain, the kings of shame. 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 The kings of pain, the kings of shame.
I'm Amanda and I'm 11 years old.
Can you just tell us how long you've been playing?
3 years.
Do you play with other friends or just the family?
The family mostly.
You want to talk about any of the competitions that you've been in?
Your turn.
Like when I went to one once, there was a girl and she said she was lousy at it, but she was pretty good, but I beat her anyway.
So you did win?
Yes, I did. Usually when I play, it doesn't matter if I have the queen or not, because I win anyway. Yesterday, actually, I lost my queen, and then I went and got three of them at the end.
Got three of what?
Queens. I put one of my pawns at the end of the on the other end of the board, and I said I wanted a queen.
Miss Paris, I am 6.
How long have you been playing?
About 2 years. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever beat your brother?
Yeah.
Today.
I'm William Penny. I am 10 years old. I've won a draw. After the tournament, there's door prizes.
The what?
And I won this
power.
Lego guy. And
okay.
I also once in the tournament I won a trophy, but they didn't give it to me. They gave it to some other boy who didn't win. Go.
Yeah. Radio Free School. Show by, for, and about home learners.
The end.
I'm gonna wrap myself in paper. I'm gonna daub myself with glue. Stick some stamps on the top of my head. I'm gonna mail myself to you.
Contact Radio Free School at grassroots@hwcn.org or mail P.O. Box 19, 1280 Main Street West, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, L8S1CO.